This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government.
Hello.
And we're going to talk about something that often gets lost in the history books, particularly in kind of broader survey looks at American military history, and that's the period after Desert Storm. So let's kind of peel back the history, if we could, Dr. Kuhn. So most people are probably familiar with the story of Desert Storm, where Saddam Hussein of Iraq invades Kuwait. There's this big coalition against him, the 100-hour war.
6 weeks plus 100 hours.
6 weeks plus 100 hours, right. There's an air campaign. And then Hussein's forces leave Kuwait, and that's the end of the story. Now, first of all, could you explain how that's not the end of the story?
Well, it's not the end of the story because of the unsatisfactory ceasefire agreement at Safwan. Safwan's not a peace treaty. Safwan is a ceasefire, and so the United States agrees to a ceasefire, and that sets up Saddam Hussein to take the shattered remains of his army and the remains of his Republican Guard and use them in two places where he had problems. And that was in the north against the Kurds, who actually didn't revolt, but Saddam they hadn't been quite adhering to the way he wanted them to behave, and so he began another, this wasn't his first campaign against the Kurds, but he began the campaign against the Kurds. And then there was also the rebellion of the Shia Arab community in the Tigris and Euphrates Delta. And these guys are sometimes called the Marsh Arabs or the Marsh Arab Revolt. Mm-hmm. And they were encouraged to revolt by President George H.W. Bush, the elder Bush. However, the situation was so quickly developing that nobody sort of asked, you know, what comes next? What's the second, third, fourth order effects? And so it was the agreement at Safwan that really set the stage for the post-Desert Storm period. And I call this period from March of 1991 until the beginning of Operation Southern Focus in 2002, the Cold War against Iraq. So this is the period of Cold War. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a Cold War that has hot elements in it. Mm-hmm. And so and it's going to revolve principally around no-fly zones in the northern part of Iraq and a northern fly zone in the southern part of Iraq. And these two no-fly zones are not part of an overall singular unitary campaign. They're actually completely separate. They're actually done by two different COCOMs. Northern Watch, which began as Provide Comfort for the Kurds, was conducted by UCOM, and Southern Watch was conducted by CENTCOM. But timing here is everything. We need to talk about that. Mm-hmm. So that's what's going on. The other major thing going here is the sanctions regime. There was still a sanctions regime in place. Safwan did not eliminate the sanctions on Saddam Hussein. Those sanctions remained in place, principally Saddam Hussein's ability to sell oil on the open market. If we did to Putin what we did to Saddam Hussein, Putin would have to end the war in Ukraine. He'd probably fall from power. But we haven't done that, although we've tried to do something like it. But that sanctions regime was to deny Saddam Hussein the ability to get hard cash so that he could build his army back up again and re-equip his army again under the table, as it were, from Russia and France, mm-hmm. who were his primary supporters, and also in order to develop his various weapons programs, including his nuclear program, which was one of the UN sanctions was that he would dismantle his thing. And then that part of it isn't actually Safwan. That actually comes under the mandate of the UN and the atomic International Atomic Energy the
agency, IAEA.
Yeah. So that came under that. Yeah. So those sanctions were essentially a maritime blockade.
So, and that's the word I wanted you to use is like. So this isn't just we're saying not do this. We're actually putting in place.
Yes,
to
we
do
are
that.
Boarding Iraqi ships, and actually before 9/11 began, this was the other major military operation in place. Mm-hmm. Was doing visit board search and seizure. The actual visit board search and seizure of Iraqi sanctions violators didn't really intensify until after 1998 in Operation Desert Fox, mm-hmm. which was President Clinton's after Saddam Hussein threw the UN IAEA inspectors out of Iraq. That was President Clinton's way to just kind of slap Saddam Hussein on the way out the door. It didn't really, and it was a limited contingent. It was kind of like what happened to the Houthis with Poseidon Archer in 2024, which is just a very limited signal sending bombing campaign that really didn't do much of anything.
Okay, yeah. So we've got a really good setup for kind of a broad overview of the history period. Let's talk about your own career, because you're not just Dr. Kuhn, naval historian. You also were involved in all of this. So walk us through a little bit about your career.
So I was a Navy officer, and I was involved in the planning for the air campaign for Desert Storm on board the Kennedy. I worked for Admiral Mixon, who commanded the Red Sea Battle Force. It was three aircraft carrier strike groups, battle groups we called them back then. So I was actually involved in the air campaign planning before Southern Watch. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I kind of knew the terrain. I knew what was going on. I knew the major air bases in Iraq. I had committed all of those to memories. I knew the order of battle, although I had to know less of it, although I never forgot about it because that order of battle went to Iran, and Iran was also another place that. But I was the electronic warfare officer. I was mostly concerned with the air defense system. And during Southern Watch, that would be one of the primary factors that governed how Southern Watch was conducted, was the Iraqi air defense system. Mm-hmm. And so I was an expert on the Iraqi air defense system, both pre-war, during the war, and then after the war, and I was involved in the planning. Okay, well, after that, I got assigned to Japan. This is when I leave the theater in February of 1991, as the air campaign's winding down, I was gone by the time the ground war occurred. I moved my family in the month that I had in March. I moved my family to Japan, and I joined a wing staff in Japan. I'll get back to that later. So my part of the story ends with that, but the no-fly zone part of the story actually is just beginning. So one of the things that comes out of Desert Storm is this idea of the utility of air power. Mm-hmm. Air power advocates in all the service, but particularly the Navy and the Air Force, argued that the air campaign was far more important than many people thought it was. Mm-hmm. And there was a study, the Gulf War Air Power Survey. Okay, and so there's this idea of the utility of air power. Well, almost immediately, air power was used to manage the security situation in the Middle East, around Iraq, particularly in the Persian Gulf. Although we had to call it the Arabian Gulf at the time, but now everybody calls it the Persian Gulf again. And the first thing that happened was we realized we'd screwed up in letting Saddam Hussein continue helicopter flight operations as one of the terms of the... They asked if they could use helicopters for logistics. So they used helicopters against their own people to put down the Marsh Rebellion, particularly the MI-8 HIP. And they also were using helicopters and aircraft up north. So the first place that the no-fly zone idea got implemented was up in northern Iraq, all right? So Southern Watch is not a direct response to us trying to prevent Saddam Hussein from putting down an insurgency in the southern part of the country. Actually, the first thing we do is an operation called Provide Comfort, where we actually bring in humanitarian aid to the Kurds who are hiding in the mountains of northern Iraq from Saddam's Republican Guard and his air forces. And then in order to eliminate the air forces, EUCOM implements Northern Watch. So Northern Watch is the first no-fly zone. Mm-hmm. This is really the first no-fly zone in military history. Is Northern Watch.
And this includes fixed wing and rotary wing? Just fixed wing?
Fixed wing and rotary wing. Okay. So total no-fly zone.
So what were the rules to use there?
Well, they kind of developed the rules as they went along, all right? They followed sort of classic rules of engagement. You didn't do revenge strikes. If you were attacked, you could respond, but only with proportional, and only if, you know, you were defending yourself. So the ROE were initially basically you have the inherent right of self-defense and you have to keep your response proportional. So that was the ROE. And that's sort of the standard ROE. But they came up with, we had a nickname for the ROE, but they came up with a series of ROMTs. And I forget whether we called them Program 1 Response or Response. But anyway, there were initially four responses. Eventually, there was a fifth response that we were allowed to do later on as the no-fly zone regimes went on. So Northern Watch was the first one, primarily supported from Turkey, from bases in Turkey, and using Air Force assets for the most part to do the Northern mm-hmm. Watch. It was only the northern third of the country. So essentially the northern part of Iraq all the way down to about Mosul was a no-fly zone.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, obviously the Bush administration saw what was happening in southern Iraq and they thought, well, you know what? We should do that in the south. By the time Southern Watch, which occurs later in 1991, is implemented, the rebellion has been put down.
Mm-hmm.
However, it's not because its initial cause, which was to support the Arab rebellion, is gone before it's implemented. It becomes another tool to leverage the Iraqis to meet the UN sanctions mm-hmm. and to meet all the UN Security Council resolutions that apply to them, particularly for their nuclear program, their weapons of mass destruction program, and their weapons programs, mm-hmm. all right, and their ability to buy weapons and everything. So Southern Watch becomes that, and that is the southern third of Iraq all the way to just north of Basra. So actually, Iraq only controls the middle third of its airspace.
Mm-hmm.
These are the Arab Sunni community. So in the south, it's the Arab Shia community. Mm-hmm. In the north, it's the Kurdish Muslim community. And in the middle, it's the Sunni Arabs,
mm-hmm.
who are Saddam Hussein's biggest supporters,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's where the bulk of his power and support come from.
So we have these two no-fly zones. You mentioned that they're, you know, one of them is run out of Turkey, one of them is run out of the CENTCOM, presumably a lot of naval assets.
Right.
Is there a difference in the application from Air Force in the north and Naval Air in the south?
Technically, no. This is flown under the new regime of Goldwater Nichols, where there is a Joint Forces Air Component Commander who is basically running each of these no-fly zones. If for EUCOM, it will be a CAOC. It'll be a Coalition Air Operations Center, but it'll be a numbered Air Force commander, mm-hmm. whoever has the authority over Turkey, whichever numbered Air Force has the authority, and he will run it. But and we're gonna, this will come up again. But essentially, it's being run. I think the CAOC, or the Air Operations Center for Northern Watch, is actually in Incirlik, if I remember correctly.
Which is the major air base in Turkey.
Which is the major air base in Turkey, right? And this is where the bulk of the sorties are coming from, and they're all mostly Air Force. In fact, I don't know if hardly anybody other than maybe some Hilo guys who flew from the Eastern Med for Provide Comfort who were involved in the air operations in the North, the humanitarian Provide Comfort and then Northern Watch. So how do you do one of these things? Well, you don't really need to patrol them at nighttime because the Iraqis notoriously don't like to fly at night. So you patrol them during the daytime. Mm-hmm. And essentially what you need is airborne early warning. That means an Air Force AWACS is usually the airborne battle manager for the NOF. So initially in Northern Watch, and so they would ask for sorties. The JFAC would say, here's how many sorties that I need to patrol.
JFAC.
And so the Joint Force Air Component Commander. Okay. In this case, probably a numbered Air Force staff with some plus-ups, right?
Okay.
And so those are the guys running Northern Watch. And again, numbers of sorties, and for your audience, a sortie is airplane takes off, airplane lands, one sortie. Okay, takeoffs equal landings. So if you have five takeoffs and five landings, you have five sorties.
Okay.
So the Air Force was probably doing Northern Watch with fewer aircraft than they were using for than the Joint Air Forces were using for Southern Watch. So Northern Watch was very, very much an Air Force show. Mm-hmm. Okay. And again, Saddam Hussein basically didn't bother with violating that. All right. He just kind of let Northern Watch go on and do its thing. All right. But this led to the idea that no-fly zones are a way to solve problems. And so when problems occurred in the Adriatic with the breakup of the former Yugoslavia, the first thing they did was they employed a no-fly zone, deny flight, which I am also flying deny flight no-fly zone missions during the same deployment that I'm going to talk about that I was flying. So I actually got to fly two no-fly zone operations, deny flight in Bosnia, Serbia, and then Southern Watch in Iraq.
So this is preventing all fixed-wing, rotary-wing aircraft from taking off, flying, doing anything along those lines.
Right.
Does this also include suppressing air defenses?
Only if air defenses fire at you.
Okay.
So the rules of engagement were you can't attack their air defenses unless you're fired upon.
Okay.
And that's where I'm going to come into the equation with my skills. So let's talk about Southern Watch. So Southern Watch is very much of a joint show. It's run out of Riyadh, which is the CAOC. So the Joint Forces Air Component Commander for Operation Southern Watch is the guy who's working out of the CAOC in Riyadh. Okay? And he maintains a picture based on an air defense picture, which is built by when the Navy is there, the Navy will help build the picture. But mostly it's the AWACS that are building the picture, maintaining the picture.
Does Navy have AWACS?
The Navy has the E-2 Hawkeye airborne early warning aircraft.
Okay.
And it does the same mission an AWACS does, but it's much, much smaller.
Are they using Hawkeyes or AWACS?
Both.
Okay.
So it's an integrated dual-net, multi-frequency data link air surveillance picture maintained by Army ground-based radars, mostly Patriots, Air Force airborne radars on the AWACS, and Navy air defense radars on ships and by E-2s when they're airborne. Okay, so the network is actually a composite. So the picture that picks up the air contacts from Iraq is coming from that. Mm-hmm. All right. Obviously, the most useful member of that team is the AWACS. Although the Hawkeye, if the AWACS goes down, the Hawkeye can pick up the problem. So we always had Hawkeyes on alert if we had an aircraft carrier in the Gulf to substitute for the AWACS.
The AWACS is just it's bigger, longer.
Right.
Longer
the Hawkeye job. Does the same job an AWACS does with a crew that's about one-fifth the size of an AWACS.
And for people who aren't familiar, the AWACS are the planes with the giant discs on top of
them. Converted 707?
And an E-2 Hawkeye also has a giant disc on top of it. Okay? It's the APY-1 radar. The APY-1 radar is on the AWACS, And then the Hawkeye's radar is the app something or other. I forget what the name of it is again.
So let's talk about how this kind of works on a granular level. Take us in the cockpit where you spend a good chunk of your career. Let's say you get some kind of indication that some aircraft has breached the no-fly zone. What happens?
Okay, so again, you have to remember the United States has the most sophisticated intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance system in the world at this point. From 1991 until 2002 and beyond, the United States can build an air picture anywhere in the Northern Hemisphere. We're particularly fortunate that Desert Storm happened because it forced our national intelligence community to focus its assets on Iraq. So that whole 9 months, you know, desert, or 8 months of, you know, almost 7 months of Desert Shield, or 6 months of Desert Shield, and then the month and a half, and then another month or so. So we got a chance to sort of recalibrate everything and focus on Iraq. So it's not just manned systems. It's also these national systems that are helping build it. So you're getting what we call IMW, indications and warning, from that whole system, right? And that system might give you something called a tipper that we think at Al-Asad Air Base, a MiG-23 is going to take off, all right? Now, that's okay. He can take off from Al-Asad Air Base. It's not in a no-fly zone. But you're on alert now, right? Okay. We might have MiG-23s that are going to try to go in. Now, again, I told you Saddam didn't spend a lot of time violating the northern zone, because it was the southern zone that really concerned him the most.
So if you get the indication that MiG is taking off, you're you know, 60% it's going south?
No, you just don't know. I mean, and Saddam Hussein, as he started to build his air force and his pilots' confidence back up, because remember, his air force was crippled in Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and it takes a while. You don't know what they're going to do, which is why you have the sorties. So there are usually more sorties in Southern Watch than there were in Northern Watch. All right, because the reaction time was extremely small, particularly, and I think Al-Asad Air Base was the one that was the biggest problem for it, because I think the Foxbats, the MiG-25s, were at Al-Asad. And they could go into afterburner, and from about a minute or so after they took off, they could be in the no-fly zone within minutes, all right, and be in the no-fly zone. And that's what they would do. They would fly, we called them exciter missions, where they'd take off with either MiG-23s with their wings swept back or Foxbats, and they would go into afterburner, or they'd go very high-speed military, and they'd go to another no-fly zone and test our responsiveness, right? At the same time, they'd turn on their radars, not their surface-to-air missile radars, but their radars that supported their radar guided gun systems, which were like 90 millimeter or 120 millimeter, whatever. And they'd shine us with their radars as well. So and that's where the EW piece came in. So I'll tell you a little bit vignette about mine, because it's kind of fun. You know, it's a sea story, but it's unlike most sea stories, it's actually true. So the Southern Watch, when the Navy would put a carrier in there, the Navy didn't always have a carrier in there, but we would schedule a line period for carriers, and that would give the Air Force some breaks with providing jets and everything. The tankers, the Air Force tankers, would get a break because we would be in the northern. The Navy would put its aircraft carriers supporting Southern Watch in the very, very farthest northern carrier box in the Persian Gulf.
Because if you can just think, if you're putting F-16s out of Kuwait or Saudi Arabia, they've only got a certain amount of play time before they got a tank.
Well, they've got a tank, then they go into no-fly zone, and then they tank on their way out. Right. Yeah. For the Navy, we could launch without tanking and be right in the no-fly zone.
Right.
So we were the most flexible, easy, and reactive force.
This is the advantage of the aircraft carrier.
Right. We always had a couple of fighter planes, either Hornets. Do we have Hornets in our air wing? Yeah, we had Hornets. So we either had F-18s or F-14s on the catapults ready to launch all the time. When we did our line period. And It wasn't a very long line period, but we'll talk about that in a second. But so this goes on for the entirety of the 90s. And what happens over time is people start to go, we've never lost an airplane in either of these no-fly zones. But what happens, God forbid, that an airplane has a malfunction and goes down in Iraq? Or even worse, one gets shot down.
Right.
Right. So it's not until about 1993 that things start to heat up.
Is this in reaction to the Clinton administration coming in, or is that coincidence?
Well, it's not really in reaction to Clinton. It's just Saddam Hussein getting more and more confident, building up power. So there's this thing called the Basra breakout. And what Saddam Hussein starts to do is, because he's limited in what he can do to fight the UN sanctions. And again, he's still got UN inspectors in the country, right? He begins to deploy the Republican Guard into assembly areas around Basra in southern Iraq. And the nickname for what we thought his plan was that he was going to uncoil a couple mechanized divisions and go into Kuwait again, mm-hmm. all right? So that's called the Basra breakout. Now, this is a case of attrition warfare. So what Saddam is doing is just okay. He's got these boots on him, one in the north, one in the south, and he's just going to slowly but surely kind of pick at our ability to maintain the presence.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Now, this is a long-term, day-in, day-out military operation.
This is a little bit like what the Egyptians did to the Israelis before the 73 war.
Right, right. Or what Scipio did to Hannibal prior to Zama, right? Just, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to march out there with my whole army, prepared for battle. Hannibal's going to have to get everybody ready. They're going to line up, and then I'm just going to sit there all day and look at them and pick my nose, and then I'm going to march back to my cantonments, my fortified Roman camps. And this is called desensitization. So this is what Saddam was doing. He was trying to just slowly make us drop our guard, wear our airplanes and our crews out. And that's where the Exciter missions and the radar raid missions mm-hmm. came from, where he'd shine our aircraft with fire control radars, and he'd launch MiG-23s and MiG-25s. And occasionally he'd launch frog feet into the no-fly zone to make us go on full alert, and then ha ha ha, and everybody go home.
John, real quick, what's a frog foot for the audience?
That's a Soviet Su-25,
right?
Su-25 ground attack aircraft.
So like an A-10.
Yeah, like an A-10.
So take us into the cockpit here. When this happens,
yeah, you asked that.
What does it feel like when an Exciter mission
happens? Okay, so this is gonna get real boring real quick, but I want to do this. Okay, so first, what I'm going to say is the sorties get assigned.
Right.
Okay, so the JFAC says, here's how many sorties we want to fly in Iraq on June 21st, 1994, right? And so they go, okay, well, what are our assets? And they go, well, we've got an expeditionary air wing in Kuwait. We've got AWACS down in Riyadh. So they plug in the sorties, and then they send the taskings out. And let's say there's an aircraft carrier in the Gulf, right? This is 94, so I picked a year I wasn't there, so we wouldn't be too focused on me. So anyway, so this comes out in something called the air tasking order. So the ship gets a copy of the air tasking order with the special instructions for Southern Watch. The crews put together their missions the night before, and then the JFAC is notified from the carrier, we can give you, and all of this is sort of agreed in advance,
mm-hmm.
but so when they say, we're going to give you, we want 16 sorties from you, they probably asked for 20 sorties, but our liaison officer said, you're not going to get 20 sorties, you're only going to get 16, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we would set up to have our fighter squadrons and their support aircraft, which were tankers and prowlers, which were electric, and then in some air wings you might have the ES-3, and then they would fly the missions. Okay, the prowlers' missions was usually seed. If a service-to-air missile radar turned on, they would launch high-speed anti-radiation missiles.
So seed is suppression of enemy air.
Right.
Defense.
But the F-18s also were essentially CJs. They also had HARM missiles. And so our primary HARM fires were actually the 18s. But we also would carry JDAMs, mm-hmm. which we could use against. So we would do some strike planning against gunnery sites and everything. Now,
and JDAMs are the big ground
bombs. Well, they're GPS guided bombs. So what we would do is we would, let's say we have a requirement to put a package into Southern Watch with the opening of the window at 10 o'clock in the morning, right? And normally we didn't go in that early. But let's just say that's when we went in. So we started flight ops early and we went in. So you would launch your strike package, your package for Southern Watch, and on the and whether it was on the airplane for the Air Force guys or the airplane on the carrier, it's the same thing. Okay, here's my mission. You got your mission brief. Here's how the frequencies I choose. So the first thing you would do after takeoff, en route to the zone, and again they would assign you patrol areas, right? And it varied. All right, but normally they were like boxes, and so you'd go to these boxes, and you would inside the box you would choose your own patrol pattern, right? So it was pretty decentralized, really nice. So again, we're talking Navy. So the first thing you would do after you took off from the aircraft carrier and checked out with the aircraft carriers, you'd call to the AWACS and say, "Hey, I am so and so mission reporting up, checking in to proceed for mission assigned." It was already known based on what your mission number was that you were Southern Watch mission, okay? Mm-hmm. We're talking about, for the Navy, maybe two F-14s, a division of F-18s, that's four aircraft, one Prowler, and one ES-3, all right? Just, that's the package. And then they would go in, all right? And that's how you do it. And then there wasn't always relief on station by another package from somewhere else. The Air Force kind of took care of all that in the scheduling. And sometimes we wouldn't even patrol the no-fly zone all day. We'd just go in during a peak period when we knew that they liked to fly, and we would go in there. And that's when we would be there. Now, they might violate the no-fly zone, and we'd have to do what we called quick reaction missions, or quick QRCs, quick reaction capability missions, where we'd launch in and we'd get a, they always had extra mission numbers if we needed to do that. And so they'd send you the mission numbers, you'd do the quick reaction, and then you check in with the AWACS, and the AWACS would give you your mission number and your spins. Mm. All right? So spins are special instructions, folks.
So on any given day from 1991 to 2003, we have armed strike aircraft and command and control aircraft and electronic warfare aircraft flying over Iraq, prepared to, and in some cases, actually dropping ordnance or firing ordnance.
Right, right. So let's go back to the big history piece here. So in 1993, after Saddam Hussein really starts to push on the UN inspectors, starts to put significant mechanized forces in Basra, the Iraqis begin to sort of test the Southern Watch no-fly zone.
And the ground portion of this is intrinsic action, where we start putting a brigade right there as well.
Right. And so we're also doing things in Kuwait with pre-positioning war material and everything. So anyway, we put Patriot batteries in there, mm-hmm. And they become part of the game, part of the whole show, and they garbage up the net. But anyway, with their false contacts. But anyway, so those guys were horrible. The other guys that we used to have participate that were a lot of fun were the J-STARS. We'd get J-STARS. And so they would. So J-STARS, for your audience, J-STARS is a big Air Force airplane. It looks like a commercial aircraft, and it's got something called a synthetic aperture radar, which can do imaging and can image stuff. So J-STARS would also participate in Southern Watch. Mm-hmm. And they would provide targeting data. So this all changes, and then after Saddam throws the UN inspectors out, the Iraqis actually start to fire at us, but not with SAMs, but with radar-guided systems. All right? Radar-guided systems. Okay. So let me give you an actual mission. All right, so in 1995, the USS America, with its air wing with 50 strike fighters on board and about five We had five Marine prowlers. We had Marine prowlers in our air wing, which was unusual. We also had a Marine Hornet squadron. So we had two Marine squadrons on the America, which was really cool. And then we went to EUCOM and were involved in the war in Bosnia, NATO's first air campaign, Deliberate Force, where we patrolled deny flight over Yugoslavia, but we also engaged in a limited bombing campaign. So I was part of that. And so I was doing that. So I actually kind of knew how to do the no-fly zone thing because I did it over Bosnia first with deny flight. And then I actually got to be in combat. So I kind of knew what, you know, these systems looked like when they were activated and they were firing shit at people. So, excuse my language, firing stuff at people. So when the Dayton Accords are signed in 1995, the America gets pulled out of the Adriatic. There's a ceasefire. And then CENTCOM goes, well, this is great. Could you send the carrier over to us to patrol the no-fly zone for Southern Watch? So we go through the Suez Canal, through the Red Sea, by the Houthis, who aren't making trouble yet, and then all the way into the Persian Gulf. And it was fascinating because on our right was Iran, with its new modern air force that it had gotten from Iraq during Desert Storm.
Yeah, modern.
Yeah, they were cool aircraft. And then we had our Southern Watch mission. So what I ended up doing is one day I would fly surveillance against the Iraqis who were on the right hand side I'd fly against the Iranians near Bushehr who were doing operations with F-14s. And Su-24 fencers, and then the next day I would be in the no-fly zone. So my first no-fly zone mission, I was providing electronic warfare support. So what this meant was I was providing signals intelligence support of Iraqi threats to our fighter aircraft inside the Southern Watch no-fly zone. In order to do that most effectively, we went into the box with them, unarmed and unafraid, as we used to say.
And okay? What were you in?
I was in an ES-3. So we had two guys up front, one of them, so we had a pilot and me up front, and I had the master EW system up front to pick up SAM radars. And then I had two guys in the back who were kind of doing the same thing I was doing. And they were the guys that would tell you, hey, somebody just took off from Al Asad, right? So we go in. So one of our Marine sections was Marine Hornets. I'm trying to remember the guy's call sign. He's a really cool guy. He had a great call sign. But anyway, he was one of the guys that was in there. So I knew all these guys. We had some prowlers with us. Everybody had high-speed anti-radiation missiles. Then we had a Navy squadron with a guy who later won the Distinguished Flying Cross, I think, in Bosnia. He put a missile through the Krajovac electronics factory window or something. But anyway, he was there and he had harm. So we go into the box. We've got an E-2 that's providing support for us because they wanted to give the AWACS a day off. So we go into the box and right away we have MiG-25 Foxbats taken off. So I tell everybody, hey, we have classified nets, right? And so I tell everybody, hey, we've got Foxbats, you know. And I didn't say it like that. I was like, Foxbats active, El Asad, something like that, right? And I get Roger, Roger, you know, a nervous Roger, you know. And then so we start tracking these guys because we could. That's what the ES-3 was really good at, was tracking these guys. And so we're tracking the Foxbats, and they come into the no-fly zone. And so I, you know, hey, Foxbats entered no-fly zone. And one of the Marines couldn't wait. He's like, give us a vector, give us a vector. Like vector coming, right? You know, like he's at, you know, 330, you know, at 180 knots, right? 180 nautical miles. Anyway, so that was really fun because a Foxbat is a big, fast, nasty aircraft that can shoot you in the face at like 40 kilometers. So we got a little scared there, but everybody pretended like we weren't. And the next day I landed, or the next day when I flew, I didn't fly. I took off, and the Iranians came out with their Su-24s, and that was exciting. And I'm reporting, "Hey, fencers, you know, dropkick is that?" Anyway, it was so. But it wasn't a very long line period. We were only in the Persian Gulf for about 2 weeks doing Southern Watch, and then we got pulled out because the Dayton Accords had been signed and joint endeavor was going to be implemented for Bosnia. And so we were required to police the terms of the ceasefire there. And one of the terms was something that I came up with at the time. I don't think anybody has ever talked about this, but one of the things that happens with a no-fly zone is it's a no-emit zone. There's certain radars you're not allowed to turn on. And one of the things that all the parties at Bosnia agreed to do was to not turn on their air defense radars.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we went back to Bosnia and we did joint endeavor, deny flight, and we policed the no radar emit zone thing. Now, so that was 95, 96-ish. 98, President Clinton, after the UN inspectors are thrown out, he does a short little bombing campaign, Desert Fox.
That was right in the fall, wasn't it?
Right. It was right in the fall. They had two aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf. And this was right after I had left. So I report to the Persian Gulf before Desert Fox, and and it's like Groundhog Day. I get on board the USS John C. Stennis aircraft carrier, 50 strike fighters, Hornets, Hummers, Prowlers, no ES-3s anymore, by the way. They're gone by that point, which broke my heart. And they're doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Providing sorties for Southern Watch.
5 years later.
And 5 years, they're doing, well, this is 1998, so this is 2 years later. So the previous...
Oh, yeah.
Where was I the previous 2 years? I was at the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College doing CGSOC and SAMS. So I'm a brand new SAMS grad, and I go right into Southern Watch from my SAMS graduation. Like 4 weeks after I graduated from SAMS, I was in the Gulf. So I'm out there, but now I'm the guy who's launching the aircraft, you know, and keeping track of them, but I'm on the ship. I'm not in an airplane anymore. Now, when we left the Gulf, we went home, and then later that fall, they surged another two aircraft carriers, and they did Desert Fox.
Right.
It was after that Saddam directed his air defenses to start firing at the Southern Watch aircraft.
Hmm.
And that's when the ROE were expanded to allow for proportional responses by the aircraft in the no-fly zone to attack the thing. And what Saddam wanted more than anything was to have an Air Force or Navy or Marine aircraft go down inside Iraq, which would give him a hostage
right.
that he could use to leverage us.
Right.
The other thing was he had, by this point, corrupted the UN, and so he was actually getting channeled. We were also seizing Iraqis oil smugglers, and that oil would go to the UN, and the UN would get the cash, and they would allow Saddam to buy drugs and food. Instead, what they were doing is they were pocketing the money and letting Saddam get some of the money as a kickback, and then Saddam Hussein was buying weapons with it from the French and the Russians. So over time, this 11, 12 years of no-fly zone Cold War over Iraq, our allies begin to get sick of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, other people got sick of it. Some guy named Osama bin Laden got sick of it, having infidels in holy cities. So anyway, you know, we had the Khobar Towers took place. So all of this stuff is related to this Cold War with Iraq. Right. So this was this long-term commitment. Nobody could figure out how to get out of it. And when I was there in 2000, we were really patrolling the no-fly. It was like every other week we were dropping bombs on Iraq. Mm-hmm. When I went back and we patrolled the no-fly zone in from February of 2000 until we left the Gulf in late May of 2000. And so we were bombing these guys. Mm-hmm. And one day, one of the F-14s coming out of the zone didn't report in. And the E-2 said, hey, we lost contact. We think he went down in Iraq. So we thought we'd lost one of our F-14s. It's an F-14? Do we still have F-14s? It might have been an F-18. Anyway.
2000, really close.
Yeah. No, it was an F-14. I think it was one of our F-14 squadrons. But anyway, might not have been, though. Anyway, we thought we lost this guy. And we thought, oh, shit, it happened. Sorry about the language. It happened on our watch, you know. We've been for, you know, 9 years, and it's us, an Air Wing 9 or whoever, that get to lose the airplane to Saddam, and now he's got a pilot and a Rio, if they're not dead, that he can hold hostage. And even if they are dead, he can still say he has them and hold them hostage, kind of like Hamas does, right? As it turned out, the guy had one of his engines fail, and he recovered in Kuwait. And then like 40 minutes later, you know, we get the little radio call, hey, you know, your guy is with us, you know, and he's safe, and the airplane's okay, and we're all like, phew, okay, time to leave. Let's leave before something bad happens. And so that was 2000, folks, right? Okay. At the same time, we had to send destroyers down to Yemen to do this refueling thing, where we were developing good relations with Yemen, and so we were sending Arleigh Burke destroyers down there to refuel. And even though we all knew Osama bin Laden said he wanted to blow one of them up, and by God, you know, we left. And later in 2000, what happened? USS Cole, right? Mm-hmm. Got blown up by Al-Qaeda, you know. So this was a war, and most Americans don't realize it. The big, great, decisive victory is losing its luster with each Southern-Northern watch sortie. So that by the time we get to 2001, prior to 9/11, Russia and France are actively undermining the sanctions. Mm-hmm. And they're putting pressure on the United States to eliminate the sanctions regime and declare Saddam Hussein re-educated and mollified, right?
So kind of a technical question, because we had a situation in the 1980s where I believe a U.S. ship shot down a commercial Iranian airline.
Since.
Yeah, that happens during something called the tanker war, which is what one of the other topics we were going to talk about. We're not going to talk about that today. Yeah, that happened in 1987 or 1988. And that happened during an operation called Praying Mantis, where we were basically in a maritime war with Iran, just like we are today with the Houthis. So this is Operation Earnest Will, Operation Praying Mantis, and the USS Vincennes does something called a radar identity. I'm trying to remember the exact. Well, your listeners don't need to know. Anyway, what happens is the radar gets swapped.
Right.
So you have two aircraft come into close proximity to each other. One of them is a commercial aircraft. The other one is an F-14 from Bandar Abbas Air Base. And then you get what you call a track swap. It's a track swap. And so now the Vincennes thinks the radar IFF that it's squawking is the F-14 and not a civilian airliner. So the civilian airliner is headed straight towards them. Seems like it's on an attack profile, and they shoot down the Iranian Airbus.
So this may be a dumb question, but as you're doing Southern Watch, how do you make sure that the plane that took off is not a Cessna or a Boeing?
Took off from where?
Any place that then flies into the no-fly zone. Let's say Baghdad International.
They're not allowed to fly anything in that no-fly zone. So everybody's a legitimate target if they go into the no-fly zone.
So if it is a Cessna, it doesn't really matter.
It doesn't matter. We can kill them, all right? During Praying Mantis, that was not a no-fly zone, all right?
Okay.
So there's no declare. So that was done under the rubric of inherent right of self-defense. And the skipper of that cruiser at the Court of Inquiry found him innocent of all charges of negligence. And then he was farmed out, and his career was over, and he finished in a quiet retirement in San Diego. But he was not punished. He was not court-martialed. He was not punished in any way, technically, legally, no punitive or non-punitive letter of reprimand in his record. They did question his judgment, but they said because it was combat situation and that he had the inherent right of self-defense, he was correct. Now, what did that happen? What did that cause? Lockerbie, Scotland, right? Mm-hmm. Al-Qaeda said, okay, you kill one of ours. Or not Al-Qaeda, but, you know, the Iranians say, you kill one of ours, we're going to kill one of yours. So that's actually the Iranians' Quds force through Hezbollah that does Lockerbie, isn't it?
Libya is involved in some way.
Yeah. You really got to know your wars on terror
right.
to know this stuff. So this all ends with 9/11.
Right.
9/11 provides the vehicle for the United States to finally get this sticky booger off its finger once and for all by saying, okay, we'll just solve the problem with regime change in Iraq. So 9/11 gives us the casus belli to go in and remove Saddam Hussein and get rid of this nagging attritional, annoying, long-term commitment to maintaining this no-fly zone in the Middle East. And we can solve this problem once and for all quickly and decisively with just a quick little regime change operation. And I say it ends in 2002 with Southern Focus, because Southern Focus, basically the Air Force is told you're not allowed to start the air campaign until the Army invades Iraq, because that way you can't take credit for winning the war. So the Air Force goes, yeah, but we got to service some targets before that happens. And so that's Operation Southern Focus, which is the pre-air campaign, air campaign to Operation Iraqi Freedom.
So perhaps a bigger, kind of a big idea question, which is, so what does Southern Watch kind of tell us about the utility of air in managing something like sanctions or international relations?
Well, it depends on the cost you want to play. So,
yeah.
And again, because we're talking about, it's a limited warfare tool, it's a tool to both coerce and manage, and it's a tool to contain. So if you're happy with a long-term commitment to contain Iraq, then it's a very effective tool. Mm-hmm. But again, these tools have limited utility. They don't lead to regime change. Okay? There's only one case where you can even tentatively argue that something like this leads to regime change, and that's the fiasco in Libya with Odyssey Dawn in 2011, right? So you could make the argument that, but Odyssey Dawn is not a no-fly zone. Odyssey Dawn is like deliberate force. It's an air campaign.
Mm-hmm. What do you think this fits in with our schema of multi-domain operations, relative advantages, and the way we think about war as kind of a convergence across all domains?
So this is phase zero stuff, okay? This is phase zero stuff. I mean, obviously during war, you want a no-fly zone. Mm-hmm. That's called command of the air. Or as the Air Force calls it in their doctrine, air supremacy.
Yep.
Air supremacy is simply no-fly zone in wartime. Okay, so this is phase zero, and then this is post-phase four operations. And they do have utility. The problem is most people don't understand what that utility is, the cost of that utility. But J.D. Vance is right. This is expensive stuff. Maintaining, maintaining 16, 17, 20 sorties a day by high-performance high-technology aircraft halfway around the world is very, very expensive. Putting an aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf is very, very expensive, aside from being very, very unwise. So, because you can do all of this with land-based aircraft. You don't need carrier aircraft, right? But again, necessity is the mother of invention. So from a strategic viewpoint, this is limited warfare at the lower end of the spectrum of conflict, all right? And it is managing the air domain in multi-domain operations.
Something interesting, which is you said it's phase zero and it's post-phase four. So you're almost talking about there's a cyclical nature going on.
Right. It's a continuum. So, and again, my biggest beef with no-fly zones is that the efficacy of no-fly zones is not well understood by most people. And I would say, when I say most people, I mean people who've never had to actually run or fly in one of these things, which means just about everybody other than a couple thousand people, or maybe 30,000 people really understand truly what the efficacy of a no-fly zone is right now.
No-fly zones have both utility but also a caution asterisk attached.
Yeah. There's a little caveat there, which is use with care.
Right.
Costs a lot of money.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, Dr. Kuhn, this has been a fascinating discussion. Thank you.
You're welcome.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.